Before that, John Pilkington explores the unforgiving terrain of southern Bolivia as he goes on the trail of Butch and Sundance.
I've come to the brim of a gaping chasm, the path, such as it is, dropping well over 1,000 feet. Almost vertically, it looks like, from here. I'm going to have to tread very carefully, because some of these rocks look as if they might be loose. I don't want to take a tumble here, of all places. Ooh. Ooh. Oh! Crumbling clifftop towers over the uplands of southern Bolivia, the wild west of South America. Up here, 16,000 feet above sea level, strange things happen to the human body. Splitting headaches. You can't get your breath. Looking down from where I'm standing, I can see what's left of the ramshackle mining town of Concordia, now long abandoned. In the year 1906, two men turned up here looking for work. They were outlaws, but they were trying to go straight. Their names were Robert Leroy Parker and Harry Longabore, better known as Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. The going straight didn't last long. Within a year and a half, they were back to a life of crime. Every film lover knows that moment when Paul Newman and Robert Redford faced their doom in a mud hut, cornered by what seemed like the entire Bolivian army. But what really happened? I've come to Bolivia to retrace the last journey of the real Butch and Sundance with the help of outlaw historians Ann Meadows and Dan Buck.
Butch Cassidy was a stocky fellow, about 5'8". Weighed about 160 pounds, and had these piercing blue, gray-blue eyes, blonde flaxen hair, and rather small features on a big head, square jaw, large forehead. Sort of what you'd get if you crossed Bob Hoskins with Hugh Grant, God forbid.
Sundance, if you want to know what Sundance looked like, picture Cary Grant as a bow-legged cowboy with gray eyes and a bushy mustache, wearing a white shirt, a leather vest, and a hat like those worn by the Canadian Mounties. He was nearly 6 feet tall and weighed about 190 pounds. In the film, he was portrayed as cynical and dangerous, and this fit with the prevailing view at the time the movie was made, but it was wrong. In fact, like all the men in his family, he was extremely shy around strangers.
Everyone who knew him said Butch was easygoing, friendly, well-liked, something of a practical joker. One of his Wyoming cowboy pals said Butch was the best-natured man I ever saw. And even his robbery victims liked him. One said he had very pleasant manners. Of course, Butch could afford to be pleasant. He was holding the gun. He was born in Utah on Friday the 13th, April 13th, 1866, in Beaver, Utah, one of 13 children of a Mormon settler family. And as a teenager, he came under the influence of a local cowboy, rustler, and small-time bandit named Mike Cassidy, whose name Butch later adopted. And a job in a Wyoming butcher shop gave him his famous nickname, Butch.
Life hasn't changed much in these villages since Butch and Sundance rode through 90 years ago. Pigs and chickens scratch in the dirt. Llamas wander down the main street. The harvest is in, and already they've got the oxen out, ploughing the thin soil for the next planting. They're speaking Quechua, the language of the Incas, and they worship Pachamama, the Inca earth goddess. In fact, most of the daily, weekly, yearly rituals have hardly changed since Inca times.
Butch and Sundance stayed at Concordia for about a year and a half, and they were originally hired to work with the livestock, but wound up working, ironically, as payroll guards. But in August of 1908, apparently Sundance became inebriated and started shooting off his mouth about holdups they'd committed, and it became uncomfortable for them to remain where they were, and so they left. They went south and crossed the Pilcomayo and headed for Tupisa.
I've crossed the River Pilcomayo several times now and was starting to take it for granted until now, for the first time, I have to cross it without a bridge. This is one of the great rivers of South America after the Amazon and the Orinoco. The water, very, very murky, which makes it difficult to see the bottom. I'm just stepping into the shallows now and out into the main stream. Oh, very rocky. I'm using a stick to help keep my balance, but not very effectively. This force of the current. And of course, I can't see the bottom. I'm into shallower water at last. Coming up on the opposite bank. And at last, I'm climbing up onto the bank.
This is a land where you have to keep your wits about you. And that would have appealed to Butch, as we know from a letter he wrote on November the 12th, 1907, in Santa Cruz.
To the boys at Concordia. We arrived here about 3 weeks ago, after a very pleasant journey, and found just the place I've been looking for 20 years. This is a town of 18,000, and 14,000 are females. Some of them are birds. This is the only place for old fellows like myself. One never gets too old if he has blue eyes and a red face, and looks capable of making a blue-eyed baby boy. Oh, God. If I could call back 20 years and have red hair with this complexion of mine, I'd be very happy. We rented a house, hired a cook, and are living like gentlemen. If I don't fall down, I'll be living here before long.
Chunks of southwestern Bolivia must have reminded Butch and Sundance of the Badlands of Utah. Very dry, desolate land, vertiginous bluffs and cliffs and ravines, rivers that cut deep through sandy soil, and dry plains with virtually no vegetation, no trees, no bushes, no nothing. In some areas, the occasional cactus. Other parts of southwestern Bolivia must have seemed to them as foreign as they seem to anyone. Areas that look like you've landed on the moon, vast white salt lakes, geysers and sinkholes and mud patches, flamingos bouncing around, herds of llamas. That part of Bolivia has an incredible variety of landscape.
I'm walking down a canyon which my map calls the Valle de los Machos. But a more common description for this canyon is the Valle de los Penes, which means the Valley of the Willies. And it's an apt description, I must say, because all around me are great sandstone spires, red sandstone spires thrusting skywards. Thin ones, fat ones, tall ones, short ones, some of them with a red sandstone cap on them for even greater realism. I must say, it's quite disturbing. There are at least 300 willies surrounding me, to the left, to the right, behind me, above me, and straight ahead of me, most extraordinary fat one. It must be at least 40 feet high. This whole landscape of southern Bolivia is wild west country par excellence. In this mountain desert, you've got to watch your water, and today I've slipped up. My water bottle's empty,
There's no water along this track for miles around, and I'm getting very, very thirsty.
Well, it's not much, but it'll do. Tumbling down the mountainside, almost coming out of the red rock itself, a clear, cool, trickling mountain stream where I can get down on my knees and drink.
You've got to watch where you're putting your feet in this part of southwest Bolivia, because it's an area of intense volcanic activity. I've got two volcanoes to the left of me, one of them active, a third one to my right, that's dormant, but two very active geysers straight ahead, about 100 yards away, and at my feet, the most smelly, belchy, burpy mud pots you could ever imagine. In fact, just right at my feet, I can feel the heat in the soil. It's funny because at this time of the early morning, the air temperature is 15 degrees or so below zero, and yet the soil is piping hot. There are little holes at my feet, and occasionally each one sends up a little puff of sulphurous fumes, and these holes keep appearing. And just as I said that, one appeared at my feet and sent a little smoke signal to me, which I think is telling me to get out of here. The rubber of my boots is beginning to melt.
Walking in Bolivia is always going to be a matter of the agony and the ecstasy. And after the agony of the last few days, I'm enjoying the ecstasy of the hot springs of Tallulah. A thermal spring in the rock high above the Rio Pulcamayo is issuing into three thermal pools. One I've discovered much too hot, the other much too cold, and the centre one, which I'm in at the moment, is just right. So despite the dead leaves and the dead tadpoles, I'm having the time of my life.
I've now reached the Cordillera de los Frailes, west of the city of Sucre, and would you believe it, I'm walking down an Inca stairway. This Inca road, which zigzags down the western face of the Cordillera, must be at least 1,000 years old. Just look at this paving work here, the slabs so finely set that I can't even force a penknife between them. What master craftsmen these Inca engineers were. The great stone slabs up to a metre across, the corners worn smooth by the hooves and feet of 1,000 years of traffic.
And for the last 450 of those years, much of that traffic has been in Bolivia's famous precious metals: gold, silver, tin, zinc and lead. In 1908, this corner of the country was a hotbed of prospecting and mining. Much of this was the work of Aramayo Franque and Company, an Anglo-Bolivian operation which made millions for its owners. It's a bit of a detour, but I'm on my way to the one-time house of one of these owners, Carlos Franque, in his prime, the third wealthiest man in Bolivia.
Lever open the trapdoor. And beneath it, another trapdoor and steps, yes, leading down.
You're going to the mina.
Leading down to the mine.
This is oscuro. No?
Ah, it's all dark. Necesito una lanterna, no?
Lanterna.
I'll just go down a few steps because he says it's all pitch dark. And it certainly is. Going down beneath the house now. And bending double to get under the floor, it leads into what seems to me to be a secret chamber. I'm absolutely certain that this is where Carlos... Whoops! Oh, there's a hole here. I wonder how far down that goes. There's a great hole in the floor. I nearly stepped in it.
and across to where... looks like the beginning of a passage, Reynaldo. A passage. Yep. Definitely a passage here leading further and further underground. I'm coming out. Out into the sunshine.
This is of secrets, the family of Frank.
This is his secret gold store, yes?
Yes.
And this was also his escape route. Because there's a passageway. There's a passageway leading down towards the river. Let's get that that false floor back in place again. In it goes. A perfect fit.
Well, I can see why Carlos was nervous. There was a lot of money around. A miner's pay wasn't great, but there were a great many of them, and the payrolls must have added up to very big money. Every week, a huge amount of cash had to be taken to each mine on horseback. And remember, it was the job of guarding this that Butch and Sundance had been doing at Concordia. Unlikely, you might think, for a couple of old outlaws who used to belong to the Wild Bunch.
They were well thought of by the people they worked with in Bolivia, and Percy Seibert, who was their boss, thought highly of them, so highly that he had Sunday dinner with them at his home at Concordia, even though he at first suspected and then later knew that they were bandits. In one incident that has been reported by a couple of witnesses, they tipped off another mine owner about a kidnapping plot and volunteered to protect the mine owner.
It's worth pointing out that they were intelligent and industrious and responsible and very good at what they did, so they earned the respect of the people they worked with.
What went wrong probably is you can't get rich working as a payroll guard. And it's possible that they decided this couldn't go on forever and they needed to get a large chunk of money together and find another ranch and make another attempt to settle down.
In November 1908, Butch and Sundance went to a secret hideout on the road to an Aramayo Franque mine called Quechisla, and there they lay in wait.
Well, it took some finding, but I think I've got it. The site of Butch and Sundance's very last holdup. At the foot of a hill called Huacahuanyusca, down which a trail winds to a beautiful spot, actually, with a little stream flowing by some rocks formed into a sort of cave. Well, I don't know what they were thinking as they were waiting here in this cave, but I'm thinking what a wonderful site for a holdup. It's the perfect place. Miles from anywhere. I mean, it's probably the most isolated spot on the entire route that payroll was due to have taken. Let's just go inside this cave here. It certainly would have been a good hideout because you can see the trail, but people coming down that trail wouldn't be able to see you.
Muy señores míos, las 9:30 de la mañana...
My dear sirs, at 9:30 this morning, we were surprised by two Yankees, whose faces were covered with bandanas and whose rifles were cocked and ready to fire at our slightest suspicious movement. They ordered us to hand over the money we were carrying, to which I answered that they could search us and take whatever they wanted, as we were hardly in a position to offer any resistance. One of them quickly began to search our saddlebags, and not finding what he was looking for, demanded that we unload our baggage, specifying that they were not interested in our personal money, nor in any articles that belonged to us, but only in the money that we were carrying for the company. The two Yankees wore new, dark red, thin whale corduroy suits, with narrow, soft brim hats, the brims turned down in such a way that, with the bandanas tied behind their ears, only their eyes could be seen. Certainly, these bandits had been in Tupisa for some time, studying our company's habits and preparing their strike with total coolness and knowledge.
From this moment, their plan fell apart. Pursued by police and soldiers, Butch and Sundance zigzagged across the Altiplano. In the middle of the night, they stumbled up to the house of their friend, the mining engineer A.G. Francis.
I was sleeping in a hammock slung between two posts on the veranda, when about 1 o'clock, I was awakened by the barking of my dogs, and, looking towards the road, dimly discerned two horsemen approaching, one leading a spare animal. I called out, "Quién es, son? Who are you?" And Butch's voice answered, "Don't you know your old horse in the dark, kid?" I immediately tumbled out and helped them to unsaddle. Butch appeared to be sick, and after taking his gear into my room, immediately turned in. Sundance and I, however, went into the dining room, and he made a very fair meal on whatever I could find, during which he entertained me with an account of their latest exploit. We were all astir shortly after daybreak. At about 10 a.m., we received our first tidings from Tupisa by the arrival of an acquaintance on a spent horse, who exclaimed as he dismounted, "You'd better get out of this, boys. They're saddling up 100 men to come after you." After he'd refreshed himself with a drink, the newcomer told us that the news of the holdup had reached Tupisa the previous evening, and that parties of soldiers accompanied by Indian trackers had been out all night searching for traces of the outlaws. When he'd gone, Sundance turned to me. "You might tell that boy of yours to get breakfast ready quickly, will you, kid?" he said. "I suppose we'd better be moving."
I spent the last 3 hours bouncing in the back of a lorry across the Altiplano, getting covered with dust, and all so that I can come to the town of San Vicente. Not much of a town, really. There are no more than about 40 people living here, and most of the mud and corrugated iron buildings are empty and decaying away. By golly, it's cold. How anyone can do anything in these temperatures is beyond me. It's a godforsaken place. Rubbish in the stream. The stream isn't actually flowing, it's frozen solid, because as the sun goes down, the temperature is now -5 Celsius and falling. A wretched place. The few remaining inhabitants just standing around looking really rather miserable, I have to say. But San Vicente is one of the most famous non-places in Bolivia, because here it was on a November evening in 1908 that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid met their doom.
After they left Cucho, they climbed into the mountains and the landscape became increasingly barren and the temperature dropped as they gained altitude. And when they finally crested a hill and rode down into the dusty, treeless bowl where San Vicente huddled at 14,300 feet above sea level, the sun had dropped behind the horizon and a bitterly cold wind pierced their cashmere jackets. The local corregidor, who's an official akin to a mayor, directed them to a home where they could find lodging and fodder for their mules. They were shown to a one-room adobe hut that opened off of the walled patio. The corregidor chatted with them briefly and arranged for their landlord to go purchase beer and sardines for what would be their last supper.
The corregidor then went to a nearby home where a four-man posse from Uyuni was staying. The posse, which consisted of one police inspector, an army captain, and two soldiers, had arrived that afternoon. The captain was indisposed, probably sleeping, as captains are wont to do, when the corregidor arrived, but the policemen and the soldiers then loaded their rifles and accompanied the corregidor back to the home where Butch and Sundance were staying. They entered the gate, apparently single file, and were crossing the patio when Butch suddenly appeared in the doorway and shot one of the soldiers. The soldier fired back before dropping his rifle and stumbling out the gate mortally wounded. The other soldier, the policeman, and the corregidor beat a hasty retreat. The soldier and the policeman stationed themselves at the gate to the house and fired into the patio, leaving their post briefly at one point to get more ammunition. Meanwhile, the captain appeared and asked the corregidor to round up local residents to surround the home in case the bandits tried to knock a hole in the back wall or in the straw roof and escape. But before the corregidor could complete this task, he heard three screams of desperation from within the hut. By the time the guards were posted, the firing had ceased.
The next morning, town officials and the surviving members of the posse entered the hut and found Butch dead on the floor, just inside the door, his revolver in his hand, one bullet in his temple, and another in his arm. Sundance was on a bench behind the door, hugging a large ceramic jug. He had a bullet in his forehead and several wounds in his arm. Contrary to legend, Sundance had his rifle with him, and both men had plenty of ammunition. Butch had apparently put Sundance out of his misery and then taken his own life. They were buried in the local cemetery between a German who had blown himself up while defrosting dynamite on his stove and a Swede who had accidentally shot himself while getting off of his mule.
Just approaching the cemetery now. Have to cross a frozen stream and up the other side. The gate swings open. Well, certainly less windy here. Concrete crosses, wooden crosses, crosses made out of old bits of motor car by the looks of it. I think I've found it. This baked earth slab is the slab underneath which, in all probability, lie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid to this day.
Their letters to their friends in the States and Argentina stopped after the holdup, and mail sent to them in Bolivia was not answered. Their best friends in the States and in Argentina swore that they had died in South America. In short, they simply disappeared off the face of the earth on November 6, 1908.
Bandits are always coming back because the return of the bandit represents some sort of hope for the community. And it's true any time with a famous personality, whether it's Billy the Kid or Elvis Presley, Jesse James or Jimmy Hoffa, when they disappear or even when they die in front of witnesses, folk stories sprout up that they didn't really die and that they were seen here, there, and everywhere.
In this crowded cemetery, on this barren hillside, plastic flowers flapping in the sub-zero breeze. These lads have been here 90 years, or thereabouts. Maybe we should just leave them be.
Trail of Butch and Sundance was presented by John Pilkington. The readers were David Brooks and Fernando Ribeiro. The programme was produced in Bristol by Kate McCall.